Excision number 11945, rule 3.
Mr. Claxton, Rule 3. I think you were telling me that on the Implacable, you worked with the adults, but you didn't live with them.
Oh, yes, we all worked with them. One of the jobs I had on there was Lieutenant Commander Scott. He was the gunnery officer. I was his messenger, because now it's all done by tannoy, isn't it? Loudspeakers all over the ship. But in those days, if the gunnery officer wanted to get a message through to somebody else, somebody's got to take it. Well, he ain't going to keep running about on the ship. He has a messenger. Well, I had that job once, quite a cushy job. The commander has a messenger, a boy. Captain has a messenger, a boy. It's all training. It's all giving the boy insight into what's happening. Your beck and call all the time that you'd normally be working on board. You see, that would be in the morning. You started after breakfast, you'd start when he started, like the ship service and that. You're a messenger boy for the, and you run all over, you tell so-and-so, take us to go and see you. So-and-so, I want him here once, and all that sort of thing. And when you went ashore, now it was about the messenger. I had that job for a while, and quite a nice little job. You don't do it, you finish your actual instructions when you go to away from the training squadrons. You finish your instructions, you're just kept segregated from the, socially, from the men, the full-timers, from the over-18s, until you integrate with them in the working of the ship. You part the gun's crew, or all that sort of thing. And there's these various jobs, such as I said, a messenger, and that, and things go on, and you gradually get absorbed into the whole working of the ship.
How did the lieutenant treat you when you were his messenger?
He treated you as you should be, in a service way. Normally, I mean, he didn't fraternise with you, anything like that. You were a boy. You were under him. He was the boss. Yeah.
What did you expect from an officer? What did you think were the qualities that a good officer should have?
Well, qualities were to inspire you, wasn't it? You treated him with respect. They followed a code of honour, as it were. I mean, or a routine. They dressed for dinner of an evening in normal times, and that. And in general, they'd work in with you. And if you had a decent set of officers, you had what they called a good ship. We used to call it a good ship. The officers are in a position to make it a good ship or make your life hell or heaven. You had a good captain, you were okay. Good captain, you were okay. But if you had one who wasn't all that hot, if he wasn't a disciplinarian, they take advantage of him. Yeah. Yeah, we have. But in the main, the captain, when the captain walked, say the captain come out on deck and walked from one length of the deck to the other, from the stern to the bow, you'd all stand up to attention. Discipline again.
When you stood to attention, did you salute him?
Oh, yeah. Only when he spoke to you. If any passed you, you didn't. On deck, aboard. But if you passed him, say, in barracks or ashore, and he was in uniform, and you were in uniform, you'd salute him. If you were both in uniform, you don't salute him. You salute
The uniform.
Uniform. When you go on the... Anybody, when they go on the ship, when they go on to the quarter deck, they salute the quarter deck. It doesn't matter if there's nobody there, you salute the quarter deck. That is the... Well, it's just... They say you salute it in memory of Nelson. I don't know, I wouldn't know about that. They say the three tapes on the collar are in memory, are celebrate or recognising the three battles that Nelson was known for, which is Trafalgar, Copenhagen, and the Battle of the Nile. So they say, I don't know, but they do say that. There's a whole tradition about everything. Which in its way, unless you're a scallywag, it is a tradition that you honour, you like. Yeah.
When you were part of the gun crew, what sort of jobs would you do then?
It depends. There's the loader, there's the gun layer, there's the one bringing up the shells. It all depends what shells they are, what size gun it is. I mean, 12-inch, but a 6-inch gun has a shell about, weighs about 100 pounds. Well, that's manoeuvrable up to a point. You can carry it again. But bigger than that, 12-inch shell weighs about 900 pounds. 9-inch, the Crescent had a 9.1 gun, I think. I forget what, but it was too big to carry. It had to be hydraulically hoisted. But sponging out, all that sort of thing. It was a routine, set routine. There's two gun layers, one each side of the gun. One for raising the gun up and down, the other for swinging it around. And it depends also on the size of the gun, how many guns crew. For instance, in the... I've got a book in there with a photo of HMS Crescent on there. They had 9-pounders, little 9-pounder. Only one of you. It was just like a huge rifle. It was on a mountain. It fired a shell weighing about 9 pounds. And that's the first gun the boys learned on, to fire. Yeah.
What was it intended to be used for? Was it just for practice, or did it...
No, it was small, you know, a sort of secondary armament. I mean, a big ship has a battleship has the main gun, which is, say, 13.5 or 15, Queen Elizabeth had 15-inch guns. Then they've got a secondary armament for repelling small craft, destroyers and that, of 6-inch guns. So I mean, they're 6-inch guns, so each gun's got a purpose. Same as now you've got these ACAT guns for aircraft.
What sort of guns did the Implacable have on it?
Implacable 12-inch, main armament was 4 12-inch. And I think, I'm not certain, but either 6 or 8 6-inch. Those were in the side.
They were in sponsons, were they?
Yeah, at the side, in the side of the ship, and the gun emplacement. But the 12-inch gun, the main gun, were on a barbette on the 2 forward and 2 aft. Because the battleship now is the modern, well, not now, but But the modern battleship had them in tiers. One lower down, one at eight. But I don't know of any British ship that had three guns in the turret. The same as the Americans do.
Did you have room to move around when you were on the gun, or was it cramped?
Oh, it was cramped. Oh, yes, in the turrets it was cramped. There's no question about that. It was cramped for space. Oh, yeah. But the gun in the open, without any arm around it, well, because you had plenty of room. Plenty of room, really. In reason, yeah.
Do you remember how many men there would be serving a 12-inch gun, like the one on the Implacable?
No, that I wouldn't know. I never took part in the gun's crew.
Not in the Implacable?
No. I can't remember ever going into a turret. Can't remember. Referring to the Implacable, after the landing, or before the landing, there was an Admiralty order came out about this new branch of the service, wireless telegraphy. Searching around for volunteers to take over, you know, change from one branch to another. I thought to myself, oh, I'll have a basin full of that. So I volunteered while I was messenger for Lieutenant Commander Scott. I put my name down for it. And of course I lost the job of messenger. I was transferred to Wallace branch. So then I then belonged to what was known then as the communication branch. That was the signalman and the wireless. And it served me in good stead, because when I come out of the service, I went to Murphy's, working at Murphy's Radio. It served me in good stead that I... At the same time as I had wireless training, I had electrical training, see, which was handy. Because now, I mean, this stuff, I wouldn't know the first thing about it. This is all beyond me. Because then it was all the Morse code. The first time I ever heard plain language or radio on the air was at the back end of the First World War in the Irish Sea, from American motorboats. American coastal motorboats. The first time I ever heard it. Amazed.
But you can't remember whether this started before or after the Gallipoli landings?
After. As far as I'm concerned, it started after. But it was in its infancy. It was on HMS, it was on the Crescent, if I remember rightly. We had a wireless, a crude old wireless. No, not the Crescent, no. No. I just forget which ship that was. But anyway, I can remember. It started blossoming out round about 1914, becoming the thing.
So we had you on the Implacable, and you acted as a messenger, carrying on with other training. What was the Implacable actually doing? I mean, you say it was at Sheerness when the bulwark blew up.
First of all, as I say, we were detailed off for the Implacable. We were put on a train for Portsmouth, into Portsmouth Dockyard, and got to the jetty, looked across the sound, and there she lay out there with the other ships. First, because us kids, first thing, and God, what the German chance of the Germans got against us? And this old poor old Implacable was built in 1898. She was old then. The battle, it was the 8th Battle Squadron, and it was known as the Wobbly 8. Anyway, from Portsmouth we went to Portland as a squadron. That was the, well, like, not inflexible. Oh dear. We went on patrol out in the channel, and we come back to Portland. One battleship's missing. I forget the name of it because there's so many similar. There's the Inflexible, the Invincible, there's Dimension 2. I can't think of it. Anyway, this one was missing, sunk with all hands in the channel. Never knew from that day to this whether it struck a mine or was torpedoed. And then, as I say, after that, we lost the Bulwark in Sheerness, blew up in Sheerness. And another job we had on the Blackpool during that period was they sent us up as a decoy up into the North Sea, up round the Dogger Bank. Nothing come of that. We come back again. But the first indication we had that something was in the air was when two of us, I think it was HMS Queen and HMS from Blackpool, we went round the French coast bombarding the coastline and France. It was all rugged like up North Scotland, nobody there. It was all prearranged, practice, bombarding the coast and that. And that was the first. It struck us as funny that why? What were we firing at the coast for? Really?
Do you know if they were shooting at any particular types of target on the coast? Or
just the coast. Might have been the target, but it was just... Because when the 12-inch gun started firing up, there was nobody about on deck. You weren't... Well, I say you weren't. It wasn't dangerous, but you didn't have ear pads or anything like that in those days. We all had a job to do. You all had a job, and that job, whatever it was.
You were telling me about the exercises bombarding the French coast.
Yeah. That was the first indication in my mind that there was something on the board. What it was, well, nobody spoke about it. Because the cry then was, idle talk costs lives. And had we known anything, because we weren't confined to the ship, when we was in harbour, we were allowed ashore. We were still allowed leave and all that sort of thing. So, because the main thing was, they don't talk, the officer, unless he's got an announcement to make, the captain's got an announcement to make, nobody talks. And if the captain wants to say anything, the routine is clear lower decks. They clear lower deck. Everybody, bar those actually on watch, must run the quarter deck. Then the captain comes up. When they're all there, the commander goes down and reports to him. Everybody's present. And he come up and he give you all the... what it's all about. Well, anything, what particular instance it's all about.
Did the captain of the Implacable keep you well informed on the whole?
As far as he knew himself. You see, there again, the process works upwards as well as downwards. The Admiral probably, he won't broadcast, he won't tell anything until He know till he thinks it's the time's ripe and that. And there'll probably then there'll be a conference on board the flagship with the captains. They all go there and they'll probably, you know, probably told to keep it under your hat, sort of stuff. So that we're, as it was, the last to know.
When you were doing the bombardment exercise off the French coast, how long was this going on for?
Oh, only a couple of hours. You know, a couple of hours, sort of a tryout. We wondered why. Why?
So it's just 2 hours, was it?
Yeah, well, near enough to it. I mean...
It was just on one day?
One day, about one day. I can only remember about one day. That.
Do you happen to know what sort of range you were shooting at?
No. As I say, we're at every... The only people who know the range are the gun layers and the gunnery officer. Yeah. And the control tower, which is the control tower's up the mast.
What sort of... How many... Do you remember how many shots were fired? Got any rough impression of...
About 20, or maybe. Whether it was a tryout for the guns or not, I don't know. On land or not, I don't know. But it was a tryout for something that we didn't know about. And it, I mean, if it's a question of trying out firing the guns, they'd do it at the sea, wouldn't it? At a target. But this was actually, you know, firing into the land.
It sounds like it was a training for coastal bombardment.
Yes, it was a training for something. Yeah. Anyway, from... It was about... Coming into 1915 would be about February, beginning of February, when we left. We had Christmas leave, by the way. I believe we had... We had a leave just around Christmas time, anyway. But about the beginning of February, we were sailing orders, us and the Queen, HMS Queen. We went, we sailed where we were going. We didn't know, hadn't a clue. We called, we knew we were going south. We knew the direction we were going. We called in Gibraltar. From there, into the Mediterranean. Next stop, Malta. Still, we didn't know anything. Do it. Cold ship at Malta, I remember that. We had a little... I think we had a bit of leave there, you know, allowed ashore for a couple of hours or so. And from there, well, we went in... We finished up Lemnos. Lemnos, Boudros. That's when we knew... We knew there was something, but what it was then we didn't know.
I mean, were you aware that Turkey was an enemy state?
Oh yes. Yes, Turks were against us in the war. Yes, and well, then eventually we landed up outside Gallipoli. Gallipoli was quite a number of ships there. We went bombarding. One day we went up the entrance, bombarding away. They started firing at us. They hit us on the quarter deck and it went unexploded. But that was the first time I'd been under fire. And I wasn't very pleased. It's a funny sensation.
What was your actual duty on that day? What were you doing?
I was on the bridge with the gunnery officer. I was still messenger. And
how far offshore was the ship when it opened fire?
Oh, very close. Very close. Because the entrance was only about 2 mile wide. And you had to be in the middle. And... We went in a bit, we turned back. We didn't try to get up. It was hopeless. It was hopeless for a big ship. It was all my subsequent opinion of that operation. It was all wrong. And I never altered from it. There was no surprise. There was no surprise at all. The ships were out there, the French ship, and there was a Russian ship there. We used to call it the Back of the Woodbines. It had five funnels. And they were out there for some considerable, when I say considerable time, up to 25th of April, about 4 or 5 weeks, more than that. Not continual firing, but going in, letting off a couple and that, and coming out and then trying to get through and that. And then because they were replying to us from where you couldn't see, because it was over land, which you didn't have. There was no planes in those days, not as we know them now. There were planes. Captain Robinson, he was a flying officer in one of these old string bags. He used to go up, it was a chance whether he'd come down. Well, he come down all right, but it was, I think it was about the only plane that was about there.
So you couldn't actually see the Turkish batteries from the
bridge? You couldn't see them from the ship, no, they would be, they were behind, about 10 miles in the rear, out of sight. Couldn't even see smoke or anything. All we knew was that you could hear the whine of the shells and that, the pump.
When the ship was hit on the quarter deck, what sort of damage did that cause?
Just a hole right through. There's the deck, there's the side, and it caught it on the edge. Straight away through. Didn't explode.
Did it cause any casualties?
No, none. We lost, in the whole of that operation, we lost one man, a fleet surgeon, and he lost his life. That was on the actual day of the landing. He lost his life through being silly, coming up and having a look. Whether it was a deliberate sniping or a stray bullet, no, I don't know. Because the funnel finished up, the funnels were peppered with rifle shots. We were right close inshore. But we had a fleet surgeon and they caught. Next day we put to sea and buried him, come back again to our anchorage.
When you did the bombardment of the shore batteries in the Straits, did you stop or slow down to shoot, or were you shooting on the move?
When we was in the Straits, we was on the move, steaming, always on the move. But the actual landing, the ship was anchored. When I say anchored, it got within about a quarter of a mile of the shore and dropped anchor.
When you're doing the bombardment, how many days were you involved in doing that? Do you remember?
During the landing or before?
Before, when you were doing the bombardment up the Straits.
Oh, it would be sort of spasmodic. One day you wouldn't do anything. One day you wouldn't do anything. You were just there. You weren't anchored or anything then. And you came in and you went out. But on the actual landing, the only ship I can remember moving about was the Queen Elizabeth. The others were more or less static.
Where were you based when you were doing the bombardment?
At X Beach. We were all in the plans, I suppose. Our place was X Beach, so and so, and then the other, all different places. As I say, the only one I can remember moving about was the flagship. Admiral Roebeck, I think his name was, on the QE.
So what What actually did you do on the day of the landings?
For one day, I was in the boat. One day.
You were doing a boat drill then?
Yeah. One day. Next day, I was back on board. Well, back on board same day. And we landed them. And they jumped in the water as soon as it was safe to jump in. When I say safe, I mean from the depth angle.
How deep was that?
3 foot. So we didn't go no any nearer for our own. It was only cutters and whalers.
What sort of boat were you in then?
A whaler. One of the whalers.
So you were rowing, were you?
Rowing. Being towed. When they cast the tow off, then we rowed in as far as we could, dropped them off and come back.
How far out did you get cast off?
Well, about 50 feet. Because a picket boat that towed us in, she's only a small draft, you see. But she was mobile under her own power. She did the job of towing us in, the picket boats did.
So you, you,